Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. I just want to say before we begin how nice it was to see many of you at the Kennedy West Conference last week. And I hope you had a good time. I hope you got to listen to people who seemed interesting. I hope you got to ask questions if you wanted to. I hope it was a good experience, because it certainly was an interesting conference for those of us who organized it, but we were on the other side. So if you, I just want to make sure you had the opportunity to come and to listen to the speakers and to be part of this major event for the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. And today, we've invited you here for another event of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, which is directly related to the content of political science here at McGill, and in particular the content of our course on the political process in Canada. In fact, this is the final lecture in this year's Distinguished Lecture Series. It's known as the Eakin Lecture, and the Dean of Arts is with us today, and he'll just take a couple of minutes to explain why we have an Eakin Fellow and how important these Eakin Lectures are. Before I begin, I just want to mention that next year we will have two Eakin scholars also visiting us at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. In the fall, Andrew Holman, who is in the Department of Canadian Studies at Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts, and he'll be teaching a course which is directly related to what we saw last week at the MIS conference, because his course is on the study of history, the study of the history of Canadian-American relations. So that's going to be a really good course for those of you who are interested in it. And in the winter term, someone who may be familiar at least by name to many of you, journalist and author Judy Rebick from Ryerson University in Canada will be here, and she'll be teaching a course on the women's movement in Canada, which, if you know her background, is sure to be something very interesting and lively. At the same time, she's very well known as an activist in the women's movement. I'd like to now invite our dean, Chris Manfredi, to say a few words on behalf of the faculty, and then I'll be introducing our guest speaker.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Antonia. I'm happy to be here today to welcome all of you to the Eakin Lecture and say a special thank you to the Eakin family, and in particular to Gail Eakin, for its generous contributions to the university over the years. In particular, the creation of the Eakin Visiting Fellowship in Canadian Studies in honor of William R. Eakin has brought seven scholars so far, you heard there's going to be two more next year, to the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada for one or two terms. I'll just give you a list of the fellows and where they've come from. Let me run through them. In 2007, Kerry Morgan from Keele University. In 2008, Patrick Fournier from the Université de Montréal. 2008-09, Ian McKay from Queen's University. 2009, Elspeth Cameron from Toronto. 2010, James Bickerton from St. Francis Xavier University. And in 2010 again, Nancy Christie from the University of Western Ontario. And of course, this afternoon's speaker, Jerry Bayer from the University of British Columbia. Having these people come and visit us from various universities around the country would not have been possible without the generous support of the Eakin family. And I want to take this opportunity on behalf of the Faculty of Arts and, of course, the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, again, to thank it, the Eakin family, for its longstanding commitment to McGill, and in particular to the Faculty of Arts for all that it has done for us over the past year. So I just want you to join me in a round of applause for the Eakin family, in particular for Gail Eakin. And I know you're all waiting to hear what Jerry Bayer has been working on since he's been at MISC since January. I have a particular interest in what he's been working on. When I didn't spend all my time writing memos and directives, I used to do a little bit of work in this area. So I have a particular interest in it, so I won't delay any longer, and I'll let Antonia come back to the podium so she can formally introduce him. Thank you.
So the lecture is going to last about 40, 45 minutes of class time, the equivalent of a class time, and there'll be ample time for questions and answers. We won't be keeping you from the mic, like some of you said or thought we did last week. You'll all have ample time, and then we're going to have a little reception, so those of you who want to stay for refreshments, cookies, it'll be in the room next door. It's really been a pleasure to have Jerry Baer here in Montreal for the past few months. Some of you may be in his seminar. He has been a really nice presence for us at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, and he's been busy working on his research, and this is sort of the preliminary of what he hopes to be his final research published next year. He received a PhD from Dalhousie University and joined the Political Science Department at the University of British Columbia in 2003. And I remember meeting you, I think, when you were a postdoc at the University of Toronto for the first time, and how impressed I was even then. So I'm really glad we've been able to invite you here to McGill. Like many of you, his research or his interests are in Canadian politics. His research interests have a focus on the Constitution, on federalism and public law. You may have seen him on national media as he's a regular commentator on federal politics. And so he's very busy as we're going through the election. There's going to be a lot of questions posed to you, Jerry, as we get further and further into this election campaign. His past research has explored the role of judicial decision-making in the shaping of federalism in Canada, but also in Australia and in the United States. He's recently co-authored and completed a book on federalism and intergovernmental relations in Canada. And his research right now, the reason that he's here in Montreal with us, is a comprehensive study of the Supreme Court of Canada's what we call institutional character and process. The course he's been teaching for us, the Supreme Court and the Constitution, I know has been a pleasure for him. It's been cross-listed with Canadian Studies and the Department of Political Science. He's giving us an avant-goût, a before taste, how do you say, appetizer of his final research. It's not yet completed, but I'm sure this is going to be a very compelling conversation and also a presentation from Jerry Baer on the Supreme Court of Canada as a political institution. So please join me in welcoming Professor Baer.
Great, thank you very much. Antonia must have access to my computer somehow because I've mentioned several times in the typing as I was going through how preliminary, in fact, this is. And so I don't know how she read my mind, but she did. I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. But let me also reiterate the thanks to the Eakin family for the Eakin Fellowship. It really has been a great opportunity for us to come out to another part of the country, get out of Vancouver for a little bit during my leave, and just also to be in a really vibrant and interesting place. So few things will bring a sane Vancouverite actually to Montreal in the winter, particularly from January till about April. But we've lived through it. We've managed. I am a prairie boy by birth, so I've experienced winter before, never quite like this. But the Institute's warmth was enough, I think, to make up for some really challenging days. I'd also like to thank Antonia specifically, both for her hospitality and for her stewardship of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. I know she's been now with the institution for some time and has really burnished the really fine reputation it already has. So it's really great that Antonia has done that work for McGill, and it really has a reputation outside of the city of Montreal and outside of the university. People. She's synonymous with the institution in many ways and very well known for it. Finally, and I promise I'll stop with preambles very soon, I'd also like to thank the students in my Poly 427 Canadian Studies 405 class who I've been teaching here this semester. Their participation in our discussions on the Supreme Court of Canada and its place in Canadian politics have really influenced and challenged me in important ways, and so I really thank them for the kind of back and forth or dialogue, as we might call it. And for those of you familiar with Supreme Court literature, you'll understand the little inside joke that we've had about the institution and its place in Canadian society. So that's been really helpful for me as well. People like me who do this for a living, we get used to the blood of young people, and we need them around us, and so it's good that I had a class to come back and get me back into the the swing of things. They also, I should note, endured some of the worst Monday mornings that this winter had to dish out. Here I am, a Vancouverite, complaining about the weather again. Give me a couple more minutes and I'll start talking about real estate. again, their warmth and encouragement and enthusiasm, even on the worst Monday mornings, two in a row that we had weather-wise, were really, really rewarding for me, and thank you very much. All right, so no more preambles. Well, one more preamble. I said that this is a work in progress, and it really is. I am trying out sort of a general argument on you, one that does have some generality to it, because I'm speaking to a larger public audience. I've been thinking about the details of this, and I'm happy to sort of answer details as we get closer or in the question and answer time. So I've titled my talk, The Supreme Court of Canada, a Political Institution. For some, that might be seen as something of a provocation, right? A political institution, this is not a political institution, this is a legal institution. It's our court, high court. It's not populated by dirty, grubby politicians. And certainly for a long period of the court's history, that kind of argument had a lot of sway. For a long period in the court's history, it was looked at as a legal institution, much more so than as a political one. The argument, and this is not just true in Canada but elsewhere, ran something like judges are independent finders of law, right? The law is some mysterious and wonderful thing that exists in the ether, and judges help to pull it out. They aren't politicians, arbitrating between competing ideas or between competing notions of what's good. They're just finding the law as it exists either in the Constitution or in the common law. In that way, law was meant to be pure or untainted by, again, the necessities of politics. That view of courts and of the Supreme Court in particular is probably almost wholly gone, except that in some ways the description is not wholly inaccurate. There is something different about what courts do, and I'm not, by calling the court a political institution, not saying that it doesn't have legal features. In fact, my older work suggests very much that there are legal constraints that matter for courts and that they have to work within them. However, I think we benefit from thinking about the political nature of the court and the things that it does that are political, and the institutional nature of it, in much the same way that we understand other kinds of institutions that we usually label political. So the groundwork or the foundation of what that institution is about. So the court is not a truly political institution. Its constraints that it operates on, I think, are wholly different than the kinds of constraints that other institutions, more obviously political institutions, like the Parliament and our executive, work under. But there is something that is political about what they've done, and I'll talk about that in just one second. I say the title is a bit of a provocation, but for many of you, if not all of you, you might just say, so what? Okay, another political institution. Yes, we recognize that. And the reason people do is because the court has really developed a centrality to elements of our politics. It's very clear that the Supreme Court of Canada is in the mix in terms of big political issues in this country. And so as a part of our politics, we recognize the institution as political almost reflexively. We know that it's involved in issues like same-sex marriage or abortion or polygamy, to use an example from my neck of the woods. That has led many to look at the Supreme Court as an alternative site of politics, right? That there's a certain kind of politics that's going on in the legislature, there's a politics going on in the cabinet or in the executive, but there's also a politics going on in the court. So it's an alternate site of politics, and it's an alternate site of politics that actors respond to. So interest groups and the rest have responded to the incentives that the court provides, have looked to the court as an alternate site to gain the kinds of things that they can't necessarily gain through other institutions. So in a multitude of areas, the court has become a kind of player in these politics, and its determinations, its rulings have been as influential on the kind of policy outcomes we get as any other institution, sometimes more. Same-sex marriage would be a good example of that, where essentially Parliament handed over the policy-making role to the Supreme Court on same-sex marriage because of its own disinterest or timidity about dealing with the issue. That really isn't new either, though. As my students from the class this semester know, the role of high courts, whether it's the Supreme Court of Canada in our post-1949 configuration or the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, which served as Canada's high court prior to that point, has always been involved in our politics and has always had some impact in our politics. The issues have changed. We're not as fired up about temperance as we were at the turn of the 20th century. When in the 1900s, when we were fighting that issue, it was very central to a lot of people's political agendas, and a lot of the decisions about what governments could do took place at the Supreme Court level. In fact, it's almost a running joke, the amount of cases involving alcohol in the early years of Confederation that the Supreme Court had to deal with. So the court has always been recognized as that in little ways, in kind of what we would consider today quaint ways in areas like temperance, but in really central ways like the birth of the welfare state in the 1930s, where the JCPC, for example, in its determinations about what the federal government of Canada could do, had a really important influence on the scope of the welfare state as it emerged. So we haven't, we've recognized that political quality for quite a long time. And we've recognized the challenges of that for a very long time as well because of the kind of lack of democratic pedigree that courts tend to have. So critics of the Judicial Committee and critics of the Supreme Court of Canada, back to their origins, have criticized the court for not necessarily being the kind of institution that should be as involved in politics as it is. So we've always recognized the court, I think, as a part of our politics. The question now, for me, is the nature of the institution as a political institution. What does that mean to sort of get inside the institution and understand the politics within an institution rather than its role between? And in doing that, I'm really building on a remarkable transformation, I think, in the literature on the Supreme Court of Canada that's taken place in just the last 10 to 15 years at the most. Since the advent of the Charter of Rights, we certainly have recognized the part of politics that the court plays, and in fact, early literature on the Charter, I think, focused often too much on the part that the court played in politics. But since then, and recently, the sort of second generation, if you will, of study has taken away the normative concern with judicial power and started to look behind the scenes and benefiting from much more sophisticated tools and theories of judicial institutions and how judges themselves see and acquit their role. Dean Manfredi is about as much to do with that as anybody else in the country. Both his own work and the work of his students as they've spread across the country is reflective of that. Some of the best scholarship, I think, on the Supreme Court and on the effect of the Charter is coming out of a sort of Manfredi school, if you want to call it that, of this kind. The McGill Institute for the Study of Canada has some responsibility for that as well, the Contested Constitutionalism volume, which I think has some of the best essays on these kinds of approaches that you can look at today, again, came out of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada annual conference and co-edited by Dean Manfredi. What the strongest papers in that volume show is that we've moved to an analysis that's not focusing on just the court as a part of politics, but trying to test and understand both the strategic and attitudinal motivations of the judges themselves. So to understand what motivates the judges to think the way they do and what can we see about the outcomes that come from the court if from a perspective of the judge's own preferences. So, apart from being a part of politics, it's about how within that institution judges operate to try to get their attitudes out there or to achieve the goals of their institution. So they're two sort of separate issues there, the strategic and the attitudinal, which I'll talk about in just a second. So instead of kind of parsing the reasoning of judges and of cases, which is still fun to do and is done very well in law schools, we have an incentive to kind of try to figure out what's going on behind the curtain of of the court, the incentives and disincentives that the courts face as a strategic actor in the political system, a strategic actor with political capital to spend, political capital to borrow, and potentially political capital to lose or to give up. Generally, looking at the courts as a political institution in this regard has meant one of two things, and this is the kind of work that Dean Manfredi's students have been doing. Either the judges are looked at as policy seekers with attitudes that they're trying to realize, and that helps give us a window into what's going on the court, or that the court works as a strategic institution to try to maximize its benefits, maximize its credibility within the political system. And so when it's confronted with some of the issues that it has to adjudicate on, it does so in a context that is protective of the court's own discretion, the court's own power within the system. So it's not about to waste its political capital in ways that offend the other branches or that offend or jeopardize its legitimacy among Canadians. So, you know, courts and judges work with a finite amount of legitimacy as an institution, and they want to preserve and jealously, in fact, guard that to fight another day and to stay in the game, as it were, as political actors. Attitudinal work is not necessarily the kind of thing that I'm suited to doing. It can be tested with large samples of results and individual voting behavior by judges, and a lot of coding involved. Not the kind of thing that I normally do. But there are challenges for the Canadian effort to do that. Judges aren't nearly as transparent in their kind of partisan loyalties and preferences in the Canadian system. The coding effort is a little more difficult. We don't have public hearings per se are required for judicial appointments, so again, you don't have that opportunity to kind of test what a judge's attitudes or preferences are. And strategic behavior is more often looked at through the lens of individual cases or, you know, sets of cases and the changes that the court makes over a set of cases. So, you know, that focus is less likely to be kind of large samples, but more on individual opportunities for the judges to act strategically, particularly in response to the most strategic situations it gets put into. And the opportunity for the Supreme Court of Canada, or requirements of the Supreme Court of Canada, probably more accurately, to rule on reference cases is an example of that. The court is thrust into the middle of our politics at times in ways that it does not choose, and I think it behaves very strategically in response to that. So the unanimity of those decisions sometimes, or you know, the scope of those decisions in areas like the reference on the secession of Quebec. Those are all strategic responses. So those are both really important projects for increasing our understanding of what the Supreme Court of Canada does and how it works as an institution within the broader political system. But I want to talk about institutions even slightly different way than that. So we understand it as a part of politics, we understand the strategic and attitudinal elements of what it does, but it also is an institution in the way that so many other things around us are institutions. It's my contention that despite new efforts to understand the role of the court, we still have a kind of incomplete account of the court's workings as an institution, what happens inside that black box. This is partly because of the court's own determination to keep its decision-making processes shrouded in some secrecy. I'll talk a little bit more about this later, but there are continual efforts on the part of the court to keep the mystery about what happens there, a mystery. But it's also because we know less about the actual context the judges find themselves at work at when they're adjudicating. So to understand a political institution, I mean, if we were talking about Congress or a parliament, we would want to look at the incentives and the disincentives that particular actors within that system have, whether it's, you know, committee chairmanships or electoral incentives that they work with. All those things go into our calculation about understanding the behavior of actors within that institution. But because we have a slightly incomplete picture of that the Supreme Court is an institution, we don't have a full grip on the incentives and disincentives that those actors work with. So what I want to do and what I'm trying to do in the project and I want to talk a little bit more about today is to give an account of how an important national institution impacts the overall development of the political system and public policy, but by looking at how the institution shapes the opportunities and routines of the actors who work within it. So, you know, the opportunities and routines of the judges are really important to understand because that is going to give us some insight, I think, into the kinds of outcomes that we get from the court. For kind of clarity, I'd break those down, and we have some picture of this. The court is not quite the black box that it once was in terms of our understanding. There is a bit of a sense of what's going on in the institution. But I would break it down into sort of three parts to understand what institutional elements are worth studying. The first is obviously personnel. That's the judges themselves. You know, who gets there, how they get there. A lot of those kinds of questions, I think, bear more or to do with more investigation. The key one, the second part, is process. What process does the court use in all the elements of its job? That is, whether the case is coming in, the leave to appeal process, as it's called, or oral arguments, and what they do after, of course, when they go back and make a decision about a particular case. And then even after the decision's been rendered, the judgment's been written, the way that the court approaches the kind of public exercise of releasing that decision and getting its version of the message that it's delivered out. And finally, I would break down the institutional makeup into support and the support structure that the court itself relies upon. And that, I think, is a really understood and understudied area of what the court does. The people that surround the court in terms of their help, we do have a sense because there usually is a kind of hope of a little bit of gossip that the judges use clerks and that the clerks are part of their support system. But beyond the clerks, we don't hear much about what helps the court do its job on a daily basis. And I would include in that, and it's something I want to talk about in a little bit more detail, I would include in that the lawyers who appear before the court as part of the support system of the court itself. They are, normally or officially officers of the court. They are a part of how the judges get their job done. And so I want to look at those in a little bit more detail as well. So on personnel, understanding personnel means having a better profile of who's on the court. We're getting a much better picture of that in recent years than we have had. I mean, obviously people have known who is on the court and their backgrounds. There's lots of judicial biographies, but a sort of systematic account of the kind of education that our Supreme Court justices receive, their demographic characteristics, all those kinds of things should be part of our account. Donald Songer has written a book on an empirical study of the Supreme Court of Canada, gives us a better portrait of the judges as a whole and over time, and whether that's changed a little bit. Obviously, some things have changed about the makeup of the court. We see more women on the court than it was historically true. There's always been good regional representation on the court because of regional representation requirements, so we haven't had a situation where really one or two provinces dominate, although there is a legal domination by some. As a little bit of Westerner coming out there. Sorry, it happens. Their training and legal expertise, all those things are part of the kinds of things that I want to sort of spell out. And, a lot of this is on the record, a lot of this is well known, so this isn't a particularly cutting-edge part of the project. But, understanding the language the judges work in, the trends in their profiles are important parts of that institutional map. One of the two examples I want to talk about in the sort of more empirical part of my talk is related to personnel, and that's retirement. The retirement process, the retirement incentives of the judges, again, is related to who is on the court. And also related, I think, a little bit to who will be on the court next, because one of the things we overlook, I think, is that when a judge retires, they're actually opening up a spot on the court for somebody else. So to the extent that judges think about their retirement in those terms, they're opening up the possibility of a new judge on the court. Let me just tantalize you with that for a second and say a little bit more about the two other categories. On process, again, thanks to recent contributions in this kind of renaissance of Supreme Court study that I see out there, we do know a lot more about how the court works. This is particularly true of our understanding of the docket process, the leave to appeal process. A couple of really good studies now, partly in the Songer study I just mentioned, but Roy Fleming has also done a book that gives us a lot more insight into the success or lack of success of litigants as they approach the court. There's as many as 600 or more leave to appeal applications made to the Supreme Court every year, but the court only ends up hearing about 80 of those, 80 to 100 of those cases. So, the vast majority of people who come before the court seeking its leave don't get their hearing. That's obviously an important gateway function that the court is providing for itself. And that's increasingly true since the 1970s, while the court has had much more control over its own docket. So it only really has to hear now the cases that it wants to, with the exception of those reference cases that come either from the courts of appeal in the provinces or from the federal government. So we have a much better picture of that element of the court's work. I want to repeat some of that work when I put the book together. And it really is a main site of judicial discretion. As those works very clearly recognize, and as I'm sure countless frustrated appellants who don't get their day in court also realize. This interacts a little bit also in important ways with the third category of the institutional makeup, and that is support. Because of the enormity of the job of hearing all those leaves to appeal, there is a reliance by the court on its support staff, either in the clerk's office or increasingly now in the law branch, where staff lawyers of the court actually do some of the summarizing and recommendations about what cases the court should hear. So the judges just don't have the time or capacity to do it, nor do their most immediate staff in the law clerks who work with them every year. So the process heading, I think, is at least in some respects proving challenging to fill out because the court itself is reluctant to say too much about it. It's become relatively unenthusiastic, in fact, about people asking about it, certainly about people asking clerks and former clerks to say much about it. The court has actually gone so far as to contact former clerks and tell them that their confidentiality agreements that they sign when they take on the job does not only include not talking about cases that they were participating in, but also talking about the process within a judge's chambers, that's something that is also meant to be a no-no. Lucky in some ways for us that a lot of former clerks become legal academics, and they don't care. They're open to scholarly inquiry, and they don't think that the court really should be telling them what to tell other people, and they're willing to be a little bit more chatty about it. But we also have a number of other elements to the process that are interesting. The court has appointed now several times an executive legal officer who helps coordinate some of the Chief Justice's administrative jobs, but we have a very slim understanding of what exactly that person does and their role in the court. And it's an office with a relative degree of turnover. Again, legal academics have performed the function, so we have a chance to get a little bit more to know about it. Not only have the clerks, though, been told to shut up, the judges have been told to shut up, too. Anecdotally, I've heard that the judges are not nearly as keen to talk about it, about their work on the court, as they used to, either in sort of public institutions. You can watch multiple videos of Beverly McLaughlin giving lectures like this in which people ask questions about process, and she starts talking about the weather, where she is not interested in those kinds of questions and isn't really interested in others answering those either. So the support structure, I think, is important, but I think the other element of the support structure, the people who aren't always in Ottawa, in the court building, that we should pay attention to are the lawyers. And again, we have had a sense of the people who come to the court. We think of the parties who come to the court, and we think of the parties who come to the court in terms of their relative success or failure at winning in the court. There's a whole literature around who is more successful in making arguments to Supreme Courts, both either in Canada or in other countries. But we don't actually you know, burrow down to the lawyers themselves. We tend to think of them in terms of the positions or the interests that those parties are representing out in society, but not the legal practitioners who are working with them. So I want to, as part of the project, and I've been doing something as part of the project, to get a better grasp on who those people are. They also happen to be, again, chattier about the way the court works, and so they're a good source of information on all the other elements of the project that is of interest. I'll just say a couple more things before I dive into these two examples. My task in doing this is not to be simply descriptive. I mean, I want to work with a thesis. I want to work with an argument. I'm not just trying to provide a map of how the institution works that is good for reference, but not making a scholarly argument. I think what is critical to the argument is that by not understanding some of these kind of darker corners of the institutional makeup of the court, we're actually missing something about the way that the court makes up its mind and about the kinds of directions that the court will go in. We can't just speculate that something political, quote-unquote, is going on. We want to try to figure out, where exactly are those sites for contestation within the institution itself and the ways in which the perspectives or attitudes of the judges are shaped in part by those institutional norms. And while the court is more influential than ever, I do not take a particular moment as a crucible. Some studies recently have sort of suggested, something's changed because of the charter, and that's why we have to pay more attention to the kind of work that the court's doing behind the scenes. There isn't a moment that I'm interested in. I think when we look at the institutional character of the court, we want to look at it, its full history and try to understand, how those institutional norms, some of which are very old and maybe even unclear to the members of the court why they're there, how they have an impact on what the courts do. So really, the project is still seeking to kind of shed some more light into that black box that is the decision-making process of the court. Roger Smith, an American political scientist, wrote a fairly influential article on the kind of new institutional approach to courts more than 20 years ago, and he counseled students of the U.S. court to take a more institutionally inspired look at courts, and this is really, drawing from that injunction now, from 1988, so more than 20 years ago. He wrote that, quote, courts have a life of their own and an influence on the self-conception of judges and other actors who occupy roles defined by them in ways that give those persons distinctively institutional perspectives and values. The attitudes that judges have are in part coming from outside, but they're also coming from inside. And again, only having a full picture of the court as an institution from the inside can we understand the norms and values that transform those judges from the inside. To put it in a phrase, we're jumping to strategy before understanding the full battlefield. We're jumping to strategic considerations on judges without knowing everything about the incentives and disincentives that they work with. The other thing I'd point out is that these variables of process, support, and personnel are interacting. That they do kind of shape and form each other. And that's part of the reason why I'm approaching the project the way I am, as a kind of holistic account of the Supreme Court as a political institution, because we have fine studies on who gets to make their arguments. We have fine studies on the demographics of the judges. We have fine studies on the success of participants. But bringing it all together gives us the chance to kind of check those criteria against one another. How much is the leave to appeal process influenced by the support staff process, by the preferences of judges to leave some of that work to others. So the ultimate goal of the project is to present this all as a whole, obviously divided up into chapters, but in a way that draws from all the different parts. That said, let me just talk about a couple parts instead of the whole thing. The one that I'm most fascinated with at present is retirement. We know very little comprehensively about the way or the reasons why judges retire in Canada. Obviously, we know that they retire at age 75 because they have to. They're obliged to retire under our Constitution. In fact, 1960 amendment that required all federally appointed judges to retire at age 75. They actually sometime before that were obliged to retire at that age anyways. But we don't really pay a lot of attention to retirement because we tend to pay a lot more attention to appointment. In recent years in particular, we've seen some alteration, sort of slight renovation of the appointment process in Canada. We haven't gone to a sort of full alteration of the appointment process for Supreme Court judges because no Prime Minister, that is wanted to really give up the authority that they maintain to really pick the judges on the court. But they have been willing to sort of to gloss up the process a little bit by making it a bit more public. And so we've seen some tentative moves toward a more American-style appointment process, the involvement of Parliament in some ways, at least in terms of non-binding, non-voting hearings on judicial nominees. But we, as a result, really focused on, well, how can we improve that process? This fits hand-in-hand with criticisms of Canada's democratic process and the concentration of power in the office of the Prime Minister. This is one of those examples of where that power really is strong. Some widely shared norms mitigate a little bit against the Prime Minister abusing that power. Just an opportunity, I've always wanted a chance to share this anecdote. So I once had lunch with Dalton Camp when I was living in Fredericton. And Dalton Camp, many of you know, is a sort of long, had been a long insider in the Conservative Party of Canada, worked closely with Prime Minister Balmaroni. And he told me, and I presume this to be in all seriousness, that he had to work very hard to dissuade the Prime Minister, Prime Minister Balmaroni, that is, from appointing his Deputy Prime Minister, Eric Neilson, who saw him through some of the biggest scandals of the early part of the Balmaroni term, to an appointment on the Supreme Court. Eric Neilson is famous probably more for being Leslie Neilson, the actor's brother, than he was for being Deputy Prime Minister. But he was certainly somebody that the Prime Minister seriously considered for that job, but Camp tells me he was able to dissuade the Prime Minister from doing that because it just wasn't done. He didn't reward political acumen with Supreme Court appointments. If he had been appointed to the court, it probably would have been the most political appointment since the initial appointments to the court when it was created in the 1870s. Nobody had been as sort of implicated in the politics of the day as Eric Neilson had been at that point. Prime Ministers are restrained in the way that they do this. They don't appoint their favorite friends and advisors to the Supreme Court of Canada, but at the same time, there's a lot of concern about who is being appointed and how much we know about those people before they get there. But as I say, we do well to remember that appointment's really only one end, one bookend of the judicial career on the Supreme Court of Canada. Right? It's the beginning of the career, not the end. And that with every retirement comes a new opportunity for an appointment. And I think the American Supreme Court illustrates this even better for us. And maybe we can draw a little bit of inspiration from the American Court for feeling the need to study retirement. And just let me say a little bit about that. John Paul Stevens, many of you know, retired from the Supreme Court of the United States in the spring of 2010. He was the third longest-serving judge on the court, in the court's history. He had served almost 35 years on the Supreme Court of the United States and was 90 years old at his retirement. Judges have life terms at the Supreme Court of the United States. His departure highlighted two important institutional features of that court. Obviously, with life tenure, judges can have really long careers on the Supreme Court of the United States. He is not the longest-serving judge, the third longest. Second, without predictable or enforceable retirement dates, judges can really strategically time their retirement to maximize the likelihood that their ideological or partisan perspectives get replicated by their successor. So they have the chance to decide, all good health and everything else holding for them, that they can decide who their successor will be and at least what president will appoint them. So judges may delay their retirement if they don't want to give the sitting president the chance to select their replacement, or if they're more comfortable with the sitting president, not only can they then retire and give that president a chance, they can do so in ways that are most strategically advantageous to the president, right? They can wait till a year into the term, or they can wait to other times when the president has a little bit more capital to spend on making an appointment. And Justice Stevens' retirement really highlighted the institutionalized opportunities to act strategically for judges that come from selecting their retirement date. You know, he's had a little bit more opportunity than the typical Canadian judge because he was actually holding on an extra 15 years than he'd be allowed by Canadian law. But you know, the opportunity really is there to have that impact. So retirement on the Canadian court is a little different. For some time, Supreme Court judges have been obliged to retire at age 75. That's true of all Superior Court judges in the country. Actually, some provincial court judges are obliged to retire at 70. So the mandatory retirement rule posts something of a landmark that judges work from when they're thinking about the course of their judicial career. They can see 75 on the horizon and start to make their calculations a little bit differently. You know, the wait-out strategy for a judge is a little less of a possibility, knowing that 75 is there. I'm sure Justice Stevens, when he turned 82 and George W. Bush was elected, thought, well, I got a long 8 years to stay on the court if I want to preserve an opportunity for a Democrat to appoint me. And in fact, that's exactly what he did. The other interesting provision in the rules that when you sort of dig it down into it is the qualification for pensions. And so judges on the Supreme Court of Canada, like judges in the system in general, have salaries fixed by law, and their retirement benefits are fixed by law as well. And their retirement benefits are, you know, an annuity that's purchased for them at two-thirds of their salary when they retire. They're able to collect that full pension as Supreme Court judges after 10 years of service on the Supreme Court of Canada. Or alternately, and this is like all judges in the system, federally appointed judges, if their combined years of service and age equal 80. So 65 years age and 15 years on the court will provide them with a similar opportunity. Given the high percentage of Supreme Court judges in Canada who have already served on lower courts, many of them don't need to do the full 10 years on the Supreme Court of Canada to fully vest their pension. And so we do have patterns of retirement where judges have not been on the court for the full 10 years, but there are very few, when we've compiled the numbers, there are very few, if any, judges, haven't been through every single last one yet, who retire without that full pension eligibility. So there is a kind of two-sided element to the calculation that judges are making, both that they have a retirement age ahead at 75, but also that they can qualify for their full pension before that, and so they will take that into consideration when making that choice. Even further wrinkle in the incentive-disincentive map is that after 10 years, judges are freed from their obligation to pay into that pension plan, and so there's a bit of free money for the thriftier judges in the system to guarantee their retirement without actually having to contribute to the plan at the same rates that they had to contribute to earlier on in their career. So, you know, there's an interesting sets of calculations that could possibly be made by a judge. With the help of some research assistants at UBC, a compiled data on the time served on the court and ages of retirement. Many judges stay very close to their retirement age or until the very bitter end. In fact, some, you know, retire at exactly 75 when they're obliged to, and there's actually rules that allow them to sort of continue sitting in the cases that they had heard on so they can actually be there a little bit after 75. We haven't correlated those dates of retirement with federal elections or the prospect of a federal election to see if there's a timing effect for those judges. There are some who retire at slightly early, like 73, 74, who we might suggest are kind of timing things in terms of who the appointer of their successor will be. So there are very few judges, if any, who retire before reaching their full pension eligibility. Some of the shorter Supreme Court tenures in recent years, Justice Arbour, Justice Stevenson, also qualify for full pensions because of their time on previous courts and for the exciting job opportunities, at least in Justice Arbour's case, that awaited them after retiring. That's consistent, really, with findings on American research on retirement, that the incentives for getting a full pension made a big difference to the rates of retirement for judges, almost as big a difference as the work opportunities that they had when they stopped having to go on circuit, that is, to travel from city to city to hear their cases, which was a sort of least appealing element of judicial work in the early years of the American of American history, because they were going by horse and buggy on rutted roads and so on. So it really wasn't something that anyone wanted to do. In fact, the history of the Canadian court. This is not a plug for Ottawa tourism. In the early or late 1800s, when judges were being appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada, they really didn't want to be on the court and did their best to stay in Montreal or Toronto or the other cities that they were more attached to. An obligation now of the judges, of course, is to live within the national capital region so that they can't be judicial tourists in that way. What we have seen, because of the retirement rules in terms of pension, is that judges tend to retire actually a little bit earlier. So, quite apart from having life tenure, judges in Canada don't even stick at it till age 75. If we take the last 20 retirements from the court, which takes us as far back as Chief Justice Laskin, 10 of those judges have retired under the age of 70. 8 of those between the ages of 70 and 75, and 2, both of whom were under 70, died in office. So that's actually consistent with broader understandings of retirement, and this has always been something that comes up in universities when they talk about removing the retirement age and things that deans worry about, that people still want to retire at a reasonable age anyway, so even if you take the mandatory retirement away from them. There are interesting patterns in retirement that haven't made those partisan connections yet, as I said, but there appear to be lots of variations in the timing that judges choose in terms of their age, as young as their late 50s and as late as, of course, their 70s. But judges are terribly unhelpful in telling us why they decided to leave. They're about as helpful as a prominent politician. They always leave because of family and health reasons. They never leave because they don't like the people they're working with. No one's ever said that, or because they have something better on the back burner. That said, there are a couple of judges who will admit to not coming along with somebody. Another feature of retirement that hasn't gotten much attention, so apart from the sort of numbers of retirement, is what those young retirees do post-Supreme Court of Canada. Right now, Justice Iacobucci, Laforet, Major, to name just three, have interesting post-judicial careers here in Canada, and Justice Arbour has certainly had an interesting post-judicial career outside of the country. Most retire to a bold name law firm as senior counsel, joining former prime ministers and provincial premiers in that favored retirement destination, and also spending more time with their families and taking care of their health, just like those former premiers and prime ministers do as well. And to be timely, I pointed out today to Dean Manfredi that the present issue of the Lawyers Weekly, which is dated April 1st, actually, cites headlines that a number of law professors, 25 in all, have written a letter to the Federation of Canadian Law Societies to develop guidelines for retired judges who go back to work in the law, noting that 4 or 5 of the 7 surviving former justices are also counsel at active firms. So, they've gone on to continue their law and legal careers in ways that have them involved in litigation, and they have a little bit of insider knowledge of who the members of the present court are. So there is some concern that, ethically, what are the judges finding, what kind of situations are the judges finding themselves in? So I think worth more investigation. I've only given the briefest sketch of what might be able to learn from the court's retirement patterns and rules here. Judges' own calculations about how they can influence their choice of successor can backfire. They might do the timing wrong. They might stay too long. Their idea to wait out might not work. Or their ideas about timing can also be undermined by good strategy by politicians. So stealth appointments like Justice Cromwell's. The most recent appointee to the court, who kind of was appointed just before the last election, can really take the wind out of any opportunity to have some influence. But the fact is that the legislation can influence the way the judges approach their careers. And so Parliament has an opportunity, if we have a clearer understanding of what the way that the court works on retirement to influence the personnel on the court and who stays and when they decide to go. And I'll say very briefly, as I said, not all judges leave because they wanted to spend more time with their families or work on their health. They all do. There are occasions when judges will point to tension within the court, but a lot of that only comes out much later, and we don't have a good sense of judges leaving for any other reason than that they're eligible to leave. But obviously, being eligible to leave might help them make that decision if they are unhappy with their working conditions or their relationship with the Chief Justice or other justices. All right, lawyers is the other variable I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about. And again, this is, I think, is an understudied element of the political landscape of the court. There are no special requirements needed to appear before the Supreme Court of Canada as a counsel, other than being a practicing lawyer. The U.S. Supreme Court does require application to appear before it to become a member, really, of what is called the Supreme Court Bar. To do that, you have to have been a lawyer in practice at least 3 years and be nominated by two present members of that existing Supreme Court Bar. It's basically a formality. When the court hears oral argument, it will swear in a number of members to the Supreme Court Bar just before it goes then and hears from them. It's not a big requirement. Obviously, you don't get to the Supreme Court usually in your first 3 years of practice. But we don't have anything at all similar in Canada in terms of qualifications specifically for arguing before the Supreme Court of Canada. It's really open access for lawyers who are admitted to practice in the provinces. But I would note, of course, that it is for lawyers. The Act is silent, the Supreme Court Act, that is silent on self-representation, but presumes really that appellants will be represented by lawyers. There are rules in the Supreme Court's rules that do allow for self-representation, but that non-lawyers are not allowed to represent others. So if you're going to represent someone, you can only represent yourself. If you're not a lawyer and you want to represent someone, you only represent yourself. And in the court's web materials, you find it's strongly urging people to use legal representation, cautioning that the procedures are complex and that we don't really have the time to listen to people who haven't been trained in this way. So there's no Supreme Court bar in Canada per se, but in practice, of course, there are lawyers who appear before the court more often than others. Any lawyer who appears before the court is recognized by the Act as an officer of the court and thereby takes on ethical and professional responsibilities in the process. They are, you know, a part of the court in some important way. If we were to recognize a court, it would be a big bar. In the 2001 to 2010 period that we've completed data collection for, over 2,800 lawyers appeared as counsel before the court at least once. So, you know, there's a large number of lawyers who've had that opportunity to appear before the court. And I say appear, but our criteria is a little looser than that. Anyone who's listed as counsel of record in a decision is included in that number. They didn't all get the chance to make oral arguments before the court, but they were participating in some fashion, either in the writing of the briefs or the trial element. So 2,800 lawyers is a fairly big group to get our head around. But what about, you know, repeats? About 2,000 of those appearances, so the vast majority of them, were single appearances. So, you know, your one chance, say your 15 minutes of judicial fame, of legal fame. A further 400 appeared only twice, so now we're down to about 400 lawyers who have appeared before the court more than twice. 200 of those have only appeared three times, so now we're down to about 200 who appeared more than three times in that 10-year period. And the 60 most frequent, so the top 60, if we want to put it that way, faces that the court has potentially seen, have appeared seven times or more. So, you know, a little bit close, fairly close to one time per year. In the top 25 of those lawyers, we find about half of them being from attorney generals or departments of justice, so government lawyers, Crown Counsel, representing the government in those cases. The most frequent appear in that period, who is not Crown Counsel, but is actually still the most frequent as well, is a Vancouver appellate specialist named Joe Arve, yeah, Vancouver represent. He has a thriving Aboriginal rights and title practice, as well as a number of other clients. He's counsel for the BC Teachers Federation, for example, in their challenge to the province's third-party electoral spending rules. He's also been involved in the polygamy case I mentioned earlier, the same-sex marriage case in BC. So, you know, a very prominent sort of constitutional law attorney is the most frequent appearer in that 10-year period. That specialization is not terribly surprising. Neither is a specialization by attorneys general and justice departments. They're involved, obviously, in a lot of litigation. That is, the state has to represent itself again against a lot of challenges. And again, particularly individual lawyers are going to appear often because those departments do work on a kind of specialized basis, where they have appellate lawyers who specialize in either a court of appeal work or Supreme Court work. Boutique firms with Supreme Court experience obviously market themselves as having that experience and are generally successful at building up a practice in that area. So they will sort of pitch themselves as people who are experienced at the Supreme Court, and it can help all litigants when they get there. Again, in the top 25 are a number of Ottawa-based firms whose websites trumpet the fact that they focus on Supreme Court argument, the most obvious being the aptly named Supreme Court Advocacy Group, a firm that actually specializes to some degree in aiding other firms to get their clients leave granted. So they really specialize in the leave process, tag team with the lawyers that a litigant might already have, working as a kind of Ottawa agent to do some of that work. In fact, the Supreme Court Advocacy Group's lead counsel actually served as staff on the court from 1990 to 1992 as an executive legal officer. So it was a bit of a revolving door and a bit of obviously an insider understanding of how that leave to appeal process works. On supremecourtlaw.ca, their website, they say, "Think of us as 911 Supreme Court. If you have a case going to the SCC, leave to appeal or appeals, we can help." So they are some obvious marketing advantages to being a frequent appealer before the court. They're also likely, as I suggested, to be some procedural advantages. You have a knowledge of how things work and how to prepare filings. Those firms advertising themselves, again, as Supreme Court agents come to mind. But just being a frequent advocate before the court has its own kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. It demonstrates a certain bona fide in that you were able to manage the leave to appeal process successfully enough to actually get to the Supreme Court. So whether you win or lose, you can give your clients a better guarantee that you're actually going to have their argument heard. So that's the practice side. The other lawyers that I would point out are worth thinking about, and again, the support structure, are of course the staff lawyers that I mentioned earlier. This includes to some degree the clerks who are legally trained, perhaps not yet members of their respective bars yet, but also the executive legal officer. And, of course, the staff lawyers that the court uses to help manage the backlog that it encountered in the late 80s in the leave to appeal process. So, it's now farming out some of that work to people who are on staff as lawyers at the court, but are relieving the clerks from some of the burden of helping to decide what cases the court should hear in the future. So they're writing a lot of those initial memos and summaries of the cases that are being proposed for the court. So this is the most in-progress part of the project right now. I don't have a lot of other conclusions to give you about the lawyers, but I'm happy to speculate a little. The research design, of course, includes talking to these people. Now that we know who they are, we are going to talk to them. And what I think is unasked, and what we now expect the experience lawyers before the court to be able to tell us, are the strategic considerations that they, as advocates, make in their preparation for appeal. So both in the leave to appeal process and the argument before the court, lawyers are obviously going to be thinking strategically on behalf of their clients, strategically in the context of the court as an institution and the personalities that they encounter there. They're going to tell us they worry about the law. They have to do their law. They have to do their homework. But their insights about their own work will also, I think, tell us something about what they see in the court's processes. Of course, an important part of that process is still closed to them. They don't get to see what happens behind the curtain any more than the rest of us, at least not those who haven't worked there themselves. But what they think about the attitudes of the justice or the court's institutional priorities will inform the way they shape their own arguments. And so I think that's a really valuable tool. My parallel, of course, is that perhaps only toddlers learn as quick from experience to change their tactics as lawyers. That lawyers know when something's not working and will alternate it. And so their sense of attitudes and personalities is going to be really crucial to their success as advocates. And so they will shift mid-course. They will change their anything to shift the game in their favor. Because as we know, this is not politics. It's not politics, and that means that it is a zero-sum game, that only one side can win a case. So they're also, I think, much more interesting research subjects than the judges. Even Crown Counsel appear more interested in talking about their job than judges do. Lawyers in private practice, I think, are the most familiar and accessible observers of the system, constrained only by their clients' confidentiality, but certainly not worried about the court's desire for secrecy. Something to be gained, really, in a better profile of the more experienced members of this unofficial Supreme Court bar. Their experiences and professional profiles are likely to suggest other avenues of thinking, so who these lawyers are that are more successful, their own demographic characteristics. That's another complex interaction with personnel and process that I'm interested in. And finally, just as a kind of methodological check, the lawyers serve a really good role as a sort of BS detectors. If you're doing process tracking, as sort of would be formally called, they're going to call things in ways that reflect their own lack of institutional investment in the court, that, you know, they're interested in winning. And so they have, you know, sometimes very blunt opinions, obviously, of how that institution works and how to understand it. Let me conclude just by saying a couple things about my main point and a couple of observations. So is the Supreme Court a political institution? Yes, of course it is. In fact, we have long recognized its role in the politics of the country. Whether in federalism or rights issues, the court's a significant actor and part of the politics of the country, always has been. As a part of politics, it plays a defined, even constrained, but undoubtedly clear role in the country. So, you know, in that sense, it is genuinely political. Let me caution a little bit my own enthusiasm for this finding. The court is a political institution, yes, but as I said from the beginning, it is also a legal institution, and I stand by a distinction existing between those two notions. As I said, I wrote my first book on the ways that doctrine constrains the actions of judges, so I would be a hypocrite if I didn't actually still believe this. It's a fairly old-fashioned way to think about what courts do, that they are constrained by law, but I think doctrine and law do matter. But as I said in that book, and as I said from the beginning, that doctrine and law are just elements of a multivariable context or institutional map that courts find themselves in. So there's a variety of variables that influence courts and judicial behavior. Attitudes and preferences are one of them. The law is another. And the institutional context, those incentives and disincentives we've been trying to talk about today, are the other one. There are also strategic interests, obviously, vis-a-vis other institutions. So more importantly, though, is the Supreme Court a political institution in the way that it works? Is it politicized within? And we have lots of indications, yes, of course, that the court organizes itself and acts in ways that suggest it is aware of its political role. We've moved well beyond an understanding of the court as a black box that controversies go in and law comes out, and perhaps I haven't emphasized this enough. But from the start, the Canadian court was recognizing as having such a character. The norms of regional representation, for example, recognized right from the beginning that what the court was going to do was going to have an impact on our politics, and that we had to create incentives and disincentives or rules to try to constrain that discretion. And so they've had exactly that kind of effect on the kind of personnel that are placed on the court and the subsequent outcomes that we've had that is pretty unique to Canada. You know, other federations that have high courts, the two that I'm most familiar with, Canada and the United States, don't have any regional requirements in terms of where their judges come from or what training they have. In fact, as a consequence, the Australian High Court is almost wholly dominated by Melbourne and Sydney lawyers. It would be the equivalent of Montreal and Toronto lawyers being the only members of the Supreme Court of Canada, and we've been more sensitive to that reality in Canada, and it's reflected in the makeup of the court. So we have a better picture of the court, but I think our picture could be clearer. I've picked two of the easiest examples that I can see, retirement and lawyers, that we know less about, we have... You know, these are areas we've thought very little about as a discipline, and I think that we would benefit from more, and I would benefit from even more exploration. As I said, I'm just sort of introducing the beginnings of it to you. My observations have been limited, as I know, but I hope I've convinced you of the need to look at more carefully at some of these unexamined institutional features of the court in compiling our account of how it works. Thank you.
We Thank you very much, Jerry. This has been a fascinating look into the Supreme Court as a political institution, and specifically in terms of how it's a political institution. So you heard three major points about personnel, the process, and support that were indicated here. Before I turn it over to questions, and I know there'll be students who want to get in on the first questions, does this mean I can actually represent myself in the Supreme Court if I decide
just
to?
Just you.
Just me.
Not somebody else.
But I can't be appointed, is that it?
Can't be appointed
but,
to the court?
Yeah.
Is there a reason why you can't be appointed?
I don't know. You tell me. I'd love to be if it were possible. All right. Do we have time for just a few questions?
Okay, I guess I'll go first. I was wondering if you thought that your work, which is really about the process of how the courts hand out their decisions, do you think that it's possible that a greater knowledge of the process could jeopardize the court's ability to make decisions that aren't manipulated by external political forces that would want to do so? Like, is not your work, but would a greater knowledge of the process kind of jeopardize their role as being independent?
Right. I'm not sure that that's the reason why the court desires its secrecy. I think in part it wants to preserve, just like cabinet secrecy preserves the opportunity for the people on the court. It wants to, like cabinet secrecy preserves the opportunity for members of the cabinet to speak their minds, you know, knowing that they're not going to have to stay on the record for it if they change their mind. I think that's part of it for the court. It wants to kind of keep a blanket over these things so that the judges feel free to explore different opportunities and avenues in their judgments, before they come to a final judgment, so they don't feel they have to be on the record right away and not get a chance to change their minds. But what you're suggesting is something perhaps a little bit more nefarious, that a knowledge of what ways they hand opportunities over to clerks or other things would give outsiders some opportunity to manipulate the system. Well, I mean, to the extent that opportunity exists, it already does in some of the revolving door I described. I mean, if you have a law firm bragging about its insider knowledge of the way the court works, it's not saying we're going to take advantage or blackmail these people, but we know the process, and we're here to help you through that process. There's already a little bit of that going on, and I think that the answer then is that transparency is really the thing you need to do. I'm not asking for permission to sit in the chambers when they make those decisions, but we do want to know what process they go through to get there, because I think the only way to make it fair is to be transparent about it, so that those with inside knowledge can't, be those who take the most advantage of it. So I think, an open window gives us a bit better a chance for fairness than the sort of half-open window that we have now, where some people have a little bit of knowledge and a lot of people don't.
Thank you. Ever since I started learning about the Supreme Court here at McGill, basically, I've been really interested in the appointment and discipline process. And I think it's really interesting, I believe it was like 2006 with Justice Rothstein, it was the first time that we saw a Supreme Court candidate be put before a parliamentary committee. Well, I know that was not binding, it wasn't a confirmation hearing by any stretch of the imagination, but to me it seems like it's either a response to this growing anxiety over the politicization of the court, but on the flip side of that, it seems to legitimize that very politicization. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are with regard to that and its future. I know since that happened, we have, like you just mentioned, a justice was appointed with no fanfare whatsoever. So I'm wondering if you think that this is something that we'll see again, and if it's something to worry about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these things evolve. I mean, the fact that the most recent vacancy didn't go through that process suggests that we haven't really settled on what the precedent is for what a prime minister does in the event of a Supreme Court vacancy. I do share, I think, your concern for what happens when we make these incremental steps. One of my old colleagues used to describe some evolutions in Canadian political practices. Is American government on the installment plan? Particularly, he was referring to the selection of party leaders by the party itself rather than by the parliamentary caucus. That actually is something that, you know, it's fairly American to say, let's open it up to all the members of the party. But in the unintended consequence of that has been that party leaders have a lot of strength vis-a-vis their parliamentary party now, and so, you know, they don't get removed like Margaret Thatcher was by their membership, because they can say, well, you didn't choose me, the party chose me. And so there's a little bit of installment plan going on there. This opening it up to confirmation. Presumably, if we did have a confirmation process, then with strong majorities in houses, you could see a majority only being ready to approve somebody who had sort of strong partisan characteristics if the circumstances were right. And that's something we've managed to avoid through Canadian Supreme Court history, that there are people with quiet partisan credentials, but certainly nobody who is sort of seen as an ideologue or seen as somebody rewarded for a kind of good patronage service. So when you move in that direction, you certainly have that risk. I know there's a lot in the proposals about appointment changes that try to avoid that, but again, that incrementalism tends to get you in that direction without even trying. And so we've certainly gone that way with party leaders. The fear would be we go that way with judges.
Hi, I was wondering why are personal attributes more contentious in the States than in Canada? For example, when Elena Kagan was nominated, everybody was wondering why she's single in middle age, whether she was a lesbian. Why don't we have these issues coming up in Canadian appointments?
I think it's partly true in just in terms of elements in our political culture, right? So we don't talk about politicians' wives as much, and families, and the rest. So there's sort of less interest. But at the same time, it is again related to that appointment process and the kind of transparency of it, which means that almost everything's fair game to try and make an appointee a divisive character, right? The context of that appointment is not just about really approving or disapproving of a particular candidate. It's seeking partisan gain in all sorts of other ways, for the rest of the term of the president, or the rest of the term of the Congress or of the Senate. There's a whole matrix of things that are part of it, and they're looking for every opportunity to fight it. We have had rejections of those nominees, right, and that's worked into the favor of different parties over time. So that all that sort of whatever is fair game means that those interests are just representing themselves that way. Again, we've had a lot more under the radar kinds of appointments in Canada, but I think generally most people would agree that has meant that the sort of quality of candidates has been pretty strong, in the sense that they really are kind of serious judicial people and less partisan at times.
Okay, thank you, Jerry. We always have this tradition where it comes to thank the speaker, but some of you know that I was going around asking certain people whether they were hockey fans, and one of my students said, no, I'm not really a hockey fan, I'm not really a sports fan. Another one said, yeah, but I'm a Maple Leafs fan, so that, of course, is completely out of that. Then I asked a student, she said, well, I'm not really a hockey fan, but I'm a real Olympics fan. So if you're talking about Olympic hockey, I'm a real fan. So I'd like to ask that student to come and thank you now, and you'll know why in a moment.
Thank you, Professor Baer. My name is Anita Sivabalan, and I'm a U1 political science student. And on behalf of the Eakin family, the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, the students from the Political Process and Behavior in Canada class, and the rest of the audience, I would like to thank you for delivering this insightful lecture. Now, we understand that you're a sports enthusiast, and so we are pleased to offer you this small gift as a token of our appreciation. It's the highly talked about tie that Mike Babcock wore at last year's Winter Olympics, and as we all know, the golden goal game. So thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, you can wear that with pride in Vancouver because that's where the Olympics were held, and also because, you know, UBC and McGill have a lot of past elements together. So you wear that with pride. Thanks very much, Jerry. Let's go off to our reception next door. Thank you all.